Girl. Flats are harder and harder to find in Brisbane, which has become a spy boomtown. Bletchley Park down under. Their central bureau, which is set up out at the Ascot Racetrack, and another entity in a different part of town called Allied Intelligence Bureau. The people who work at Central Bureau tend to be pallid mathematics experts. The AIB people, on the other hand, remind Waterhouse very much of those Detachment 2702 fellows, tense, tanned, and taciturn. Half a mile from the Ascot Racetrack, he sees one of the latter tripping lightly down the steps of a nice gingerbready rooming house, carrying a 500-pound duffel bag on his back. The man is dressed for a long trip. A grandmotherish lady in an apron is on the veranda, waving a tea towel at him. It is like a scene from a movie. You wouldn't even know that only a few hours' flight from here, men are turning black like photographic paper in a developer tray, as their living flesh is converted into putrid gas by Clostridium bacteria. Waterhouse does not stop to estimate the probability that he, who needs a place to live, should happen along at the exact moment that a room has become available. Cryptanalysts wait for lucky breaks, then exploit them. After the departing soldier has disappeared round the corner, he knocks on the door and introduces himself to the lady. Mrs. McTeague says, to the extent Waterhouse can penetrate her accent, that she likes his looks. She sounds distinctly astonished. It seems clear that the improbability of Waterhouse's having happened upon this vacant room is nothing compared to the improbability of having his looks liked by Mrs. McTeague. Thus, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse joins a small elite group of young men, four in all, whose looks Mrs. McTeague likes. They sleep, two to a room, in the bedrooms where Mrs. McTeague's offspring grew from the brightest and most beautiful children ever born into the finest adults who walk the earth, except for the King of England, the General, and Lord Mountbatten. Waterhouse's new roommate is out of town just now, but by glancing over his personal effects, Waterhouse estimates that he is paddling a black kayak from Australia to Yokosuka Naval Base, where he will slip on board a battleship and silently kill his entire crew with his bare hands before doing an Olympic qualifying dive into the bay, punching out a few sharks, climbing back into his kayak, and paddling back to Australia for a beer. The next morning, at breakfast, he meets the fellows in the next room. A red-headed British naval officer who shows all the earmarks of working at Central Bureau, and a fellow named Hale, whose nationality cannot be pegged because he's not in uniform and he's too hungover to speak. Having accomplished his mission, according to his understanding with the General's minions, found a place to live and settled his other personal affairs, Waterhouse begins hanging around the Ascot Racetrack and the adjacent whorehouse, trying to find some way to make himself useful. Actually, he would rather sit in his room all day and work on his new project, which is to design a high-speed Turing machine. But he has a duty to contribute to the war effort. Even if he didn't, he suspects that when his new roommate gets back from his mission and finds him sitting indoors all day drawing circuit diagrams, he will thrash Waterhouse to the point where Mrs. McTeague will no longer like his looks. To put it mildly, Central Bureau is not the kind of place where a stranger can just wander in, check the place out, introduce himself, and find a job. Even the wandering in part is potentially fatal. Fortunately, Waterhouse has ultra-mega clearance, the highest clearance in the entire world. Unfortunately, this category of secrecy is itself so secret that its very existence is secret, and so he can't actually reveal it to anyone. Unless he finds someone else with ultra-mega clearance. There are only a dozen people with ultra-mega clearance in all of Brisbane. Eight of them comprise the top of the General's command hierarchy, three work at Central Bureau, and one is Waterhouse. Waterhouse sniffs out the nerve center in the old whorehouse. Superannuated Australian territorial guards in jaunty asymmetrical hats ring the place, clutching blunderbusses. Unlike Mrs. McTeague, they don't like his looks. On the other hand, they are used to this kind of thing. Smart boys from far away showing up at the gate with long and, in the end, boring stories about how the military screwed up their orders, put them in the wrong boat, sent them to the wrong place, gave them tropical diseases, threw their belongings overboard, left them to fend for themselves. They don't shoot him, but they don't let him in. He hangs around and makes a nuisance of himself for a couple of days until he finally recognizes, and is recognized by, Abraham Sinkov. Sinkov is a top American crypt analyst. He helped Shern break Indigo. He and Waterhouse have crossed paths a few times, and though they aren't friends per se, their minds work the same way. This makes them brothers in a weird family that has only a few hundred members scattered about the world. In a way, it is a clearance that is rarer, harder to come by, and more mysterious than Ultra Mega. Sinkov writes him a new set of papers, giving him a clearance that is very high, but not so high that he can't reveal it. Waterhouse gets a tour. Shirtless men sit in Quonset huts made stifling by the red-hot tubes of their radios. They pluck the Nipponese Army's messages out of the air and hand them off to legions of young Australian women who punch the intercepted messages onto ETC cards. There is a cadre of American officers composed entirely of a whole department of the Electrical Till Corporation. One day, early in 1942, they put their white shirts and blue suits into mothballs, donned Army uniforms, and climbed on ships to Brisbane. Their ringleader is a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Comstock, and he has gotten the whole code-breaking process totally automated. The cards, punched by the Aussie girls, come into the machine room, stacked into ingots, which are fed through the machines. Decrypts fly out of a line printer on the other end and are taken off to another hut, where American Nisei and some white men trained in Nipponese translate them. A Waterhouse is the last thing these guys need. He's beginning to understand what the Major said to him the other day. They have passed over the watershed line. The codes are broken. Which reminds him of Turing. Ever since Alan got back from New York, he's been distancing himself from Bletchley Park. He has moved up to another installation, a radio center called Hanslop, in North Buckinghamshire, a place of reinforced concrete, wires, antennas, more military formal in its atmosphere. At the time, Waterhouse could not understand why Alan would want to move away from Bletchley. But now he knows how Alan must have felt after they turned decryption into a mechanical process, industrializing Bletchley Park. He must have felt that the battle was won, and with it, the war. The rest might seem like glorious conquest to people like the General, but to Turing, and now to Waterhouse, it just looks like tedious mopping up. It is exciting to discover electrons and figure out the equations that govern their movement. It is boring to use those principles to design electric can openers. From here on out, it's all can openers. Sinkov provides Waterhouse with a desk in the whorehouse and begins to feed him the messages that Central Bureau hasn't been able to decrypt. There are still dozens of minor Nipponese codes that remain to be broken. Maybe by breaking one or two and teaching the ETC machines to read them, Waterhouse can shorten the war by a single day or save a single life. This is a noble calling that he undertakes willingly, but in essence it is no different from being an army butcher who saves lives by keeping his knives clean or a lifeboat inspector in the Navy. Waterhouse cracks those minor NIP codes one after the other. One month, he even flies up to New Guinea, where Navy divers are salvaging codebooks from a sunken NIP submarine. He lives in the jungle for 2 weeks and tries not to die, comes back to Brisbane and puts those recovered codebooks to good but dull use. Then one day the dullness of his work becomes irrelevant. On that day, he returns to Mrs. McTeague's boarding house in the evening, goes to his room, and finds a large man snoring in the upper bunk. A lot of clothing and equipment is scattered about the place, emanating sulfurous reek. The man sleeps for 2 days and then comes down late for breakfast one morning, peering around the room with atabrine yellow eyes. He introduces himself as Smith. His oddly familiar accent is not made any easier to understand by the fact that his teeth are chattering violently. He doesn't seem especially bothered by this. He sits down and paws an Irish linen napkin into his lap with a hand that is stiff and raw. Mrs. McTeague fusses over him to the extent that all of the men at the table must resist the impulse to slug her. She pours him tea with plenty of milk and sugar. He takes a few sips, then excuses himself and goes to the WC, where he crisply and politely vomits. He comes back, eats a soft-boiled egg from a bone china egg cup, turns green, leans back in his chair and closes his eyes for about 10 minutes. When Waterhouse returns from work that evening, he blunders into the parlor and interrupts Mrs. McTeague having tea with a young lady. The young lady's name is Mary Smith. She is the cousin of Waterhouse's roommate, who is upstairs shivering and sweating in his bunk bed. Mary stands up to be introduced, which is not technically necessary, but she is a girl from the outback and has no use for effete refinement. She is a petite girl dressed in a uniform. She is the only woman Waterhouse has ever seen. She is the only other human being in the universe, actually, and when she stands up to shake his hand, his peripheral vision shuts down as if he has been sucking on a tailpipe. Black curtains converge across a silver cyclorama, shuttering down his cosmos to a vertical shaft of carbon arc glory, a pillar of light, a heavenly follow spot targeted upon her. Mrs. McTeague, knowing the score, bids him sit down. Mary is a tiny, white-skinned, red-headed person who is often seized by little fits of self-consciousness. When this happens, she averts her eyes from his and swallows, and when she swallows, there is a certain cord in her white neck, rounding the concavity from shoulder to ear, that stands out for a moment. It draws attention both to her vulnerability and to the white flesh of her neck, which is not white in a pallid, sick way, but in another way that Waterhouse could never have understood until recently, namely from his little stint in New Guinea, where everything is either dead and decaying, or bright and threatening, or unobtrusive and invisible. Waterhouse knows that anything this tender and translucent is too vulnerable and tempting to hold its own in a world of violently competing destroyers, that it can only be sustained for a moment, let alone years, by the life force within. In the South Pacific, where the forces of death are so powerful, it leaves him vaguely intimidated. Her skin, as unmarked as clear water, is an extravagant display of vibrant animal power. He wants his tongue on it. The whole curve of her neck, from collarbone to earlobe, would make a perfect cradle for his face. She sees him looking at her and swallows again. The cord flexes, stretching the living skin of her neck out for just a moment, and then relaxes, leaving nothing but smoothness and calm. She may just as well have caved his head in with a stone and tied his penis round a hitching rail. The effect must be calculated. But apparently she has not ever done it to anyone else, or there would be a band of gold round her pale left ring finger. Mary Smith is beginning to get annoyed with him. She lifts the teacup to her lips. She has turned so that the light is grazing her neck in a new way, and this time when she swallows, he can see her Adam's apple moving up. Then it comes down like a pile driver on what is left of his good judgment. There is a thumping noise upstairs. Her cousin has just regained consciousness.
"Excuse me,"
she says, and she's gone, leaving only Mrs. McTeague's bone china as a reminder.